This is the Leadership and Insurance Podcast, brought to you by FinPro Search Partners.
Insurance companies are businesses and they need to look for the long term and be sustainable.
We went from zero to one and now it's going from one to 100.
Insurance as a concept, as a kind of service, is brilliant. The execution is what we're looking at now.
I think the companies that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to understand and master the art of intent.
When we talk about innovation, we lean too heavily to think about technology and we don't think about creating a culture of innovation.
I think innovation is essentially continuous improvement of existing processes and platforms and product.
Right? It's got to be easy. It's got to be seamless.
Hello and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm very lucky today to be joined by Cody, who's CEO of Snap Refunds. Cody, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm good, Alex. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, this one's been in the books for a little while. It was one we wanted to get done because you and I met probably last year, I think, at ITI in New York. I think that's right.
Yeah, it's been almost a full year now. It's our 1 year anniversary of knowing each other.
Yeah, I didn't bring any gifts, I'm afraid. So I think the podcast will have to serve. So, well, look, I had that advantage of meeting you in person, and I think actually saw you pitch as well. So for the people that don't know at home, we're also in my favorite topic area. So there's some claims activity in here. So I'm always happy to talk about that. But Cody, if you'd introduce yourself and obviously the Snap Refund business, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my name's Cody Eddings. I'm CEO and co-founder of Snap Refund. Snap Refund helps insurers and insurance agents manage payments with automation and analytics to improve policyholder retention and operational efficiency.
Amazing. That's the most succinct anyone's done that for a while.
I've said that more than once.
We were just talking about fundraising, right? So you've been through that. So, you know, I reckon, does it get shorter and shorter the more you do the kind of raise presentations?
Yeah, it's hard not to let it get shorter because it's really easy to get bored from just telling the same story for so many months. And then you reach a point where you realize that you still have to give everyone at the end of that journey the same intensity that you gave everyone at the beginning because it's still their first time hearing it. And that's definitely one of the challenges and nuances, I think, around fundraising.
Yeah, just while we're on that, I've read this and we're talking about pitching to VCs. How difficult is it to stay true to your kind of like vision and not get clouded because you'll get feedback from VCs and you'll get feedback from investors and stick to kind of what's good, but also being open enough to take on some criticism or some comments? Yeah, how hard is that part of the journey?
You know, I think it really comes down to how much you value the feedback you're hearing. Sometimes it's things that you should hear, but maybe you didn't think of before, or you don't want to hear because it might be something that's contrary to a direction you've gone down, but that's okay. And that's really useful if you let it be. I think where it gets really emotionally draining for a lot of founders is even when someone might not really have good experience to be like espousing a certain opinion, the nature of venture capitals are going to give you their opinion anyways a lot of times. And that just gets a little old after a while when you're hearing something that someone's not necessarily qualified to tell you or might just kind of be off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liken it to, I've said this before, I trained as an actor, I went to drama school and I was in a play once. And we got this feedback about the play. And essentially the play was like, there was a twist quite early on in the play. So it sets up as a drama and becomes a comedy quite quickly. And essentially this reviewer hated the play and they said, oh, it's set up to be this brilliant drama. And then it became this farcical comedy. And you know, and essentially they reviewed the play that they thought it was going to be and were angry that it wasn't that play. And it was like, well, that's just, you're reviewing like the play that we didn't do, as opposed to, so it's a bit like when you pitch and you've got your idea and you've got your business. And I almost feel like some of the feedback I hear people get is going, it's just not that play, you know, it's just not that business. And that feedback is like not necessarily relevant. So, I hope that analogy works. It worked better in my head than it probably did in person.
No, I liked it. I think that's pretty spot on. And people put their expectations on things, even if only subconsciously, and that's going to change the way they react to things. So it is interesting to see part of fundraising is telling a compelling enough story, but also allowing enough room for the audience you're pitching to be able to fit in their dreams for it. And then let those things kind of grow organically together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, difficult balance. I'm always fascinated because it's something I've never been through. You know, FinPro's a bootstrap business. Obviously, it's a services business. It's a little bit easier. But honestly, it sounds like I do not want to do, very much of a guy that's quite happy pitching. I wanted to talk about claims in general. You know, and we're seeing a lot more claims-related businesses come out of the InsurTech community. I still think it's kind of been relatively slow to the party, considering that we talk about customer all the time. We talk about InsurTech and the evolution of insurance about the customer. Why do you think claims has been so kind of late to more of the investable businesses that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's a good question. So as far as like the investability, I think that probably lends itself towards the risk profiles of a lot of investors in the space and what they're really trying to do, right? So the average investor, I'll say, is typically looking for a multi-billion dollar exit. So that way, the 1% of companies in their whole fund return enough money to cover all the losses of like the 50 or 60% who essentially just go bankrupt. And then there's maybe 20 to 30% who break even, maybe like 10% or 9% actually have a profitable exit. And then they're looking for that one, that unicorn, to make the whole thing work economically. And because of the nature of claims, right, you're talking about a niche, which is a huge one because the insurance sector globally is so big, but still as a proportion of the total dollars flowing through the sector, claims are only one piece of that. I mean, they're a big piece. I mean, we know loss ratios tracking 50 to 70% maybe for the line of business. You know that, you know, 3/4 almost of every dollar an insurer collects is going to end up going back out as a claim. But a lot of venture capitalists don't really think of it that way. And they say, oh, well, we want to be more on like the premium side. We want to have like the money coming in, be part of your business. So that way we can see a path to a bigger exit. So it's really, I think, part that investors are a little bearish sometimes on how high the ceiling is, the exit potential for a company that's focusing on what they view as sort of an after effect of the insurance product being sold, even though we know it's not really the case. And to couple that off, I think a lot of investors in general might just have some gaps in insurance knowledge. And it depends on the investor you're talking to, but there's certainly a lot of really experienced and knowledgeable insurance funds out there. But a generalist fund might not have the experience necessarily to understand exactly how claims play out typically, you know, on a functional level for a lot of insurance companies.
That's a really good. I think the really important point is that thing about it's the biggest spend. It's the biggest spend of almost any other insurance business. And I suppose that plays into the kind of timeline of InsurTech. You know, we saw disruption in distribution. And if I may cynically say, a lot of that disruption didn't actually disrupt anything. It just proved that it's really, really expensive to acquire, particularly direct-to-consumer customers. And then it said, oh, actually, the distribution model works quite well with agents. And now we feel like we're at the stage, and certainly the businesses that we see that are being invested in are like net new products that are generally, you know, interesting in demand, you know, whether it's carbon credit insurance or whether it be things like fertility insurance, that there is the demand for. And then there's attacking the cost base of the traditional insurance business and building out, you know, value services to insurance businesses, which is something where, you know, Snap Refund really plays a part, you know, better customer experience, potentially kind of reducing your costs by streamlining your processes. And that's just, we've been on that life cycle, distribution, acquire more customers. Actually, that's quite hard. Let's attack the cost base. So I suppose it makes sense in the timeline of things, but I just always got a bit of a drum to bang about claims because I'm like, we talk about it being the most important thing, but then so many people have their bad experience at that point. Going on from that, when you're acquiring customers and you're working with insurance businesses to implement your technology, what are they most looking for? Is it their customer experience? Is it streamlining costs? You know, what's their kind of like buying criteria when they engage with you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it changes a bit based on the the psychographic profile or the size of the company that's becoming the buyer. So smaller companies, they tend to be in situations where they say, all right, we need a solution that's going to tie into our existing new dashboards, new tooling, because we control the customer experience from tip to tail and everything is really fresh and new and exciting. You know, it's the new baby. It's the new MGA that shows up that wants to make sure that the customer has a premium experience, because that is part of the selling value, the proposition that helps these newer programs compete against incumbents, is that everything looks really sleek. Everything is really well optimized. You get quotes quickly. You can bind quickly. There might be a chat AI assistant. So they want a tool or a platform that ties into that and organically continues that same customer-centric modern design feel all the way through the end of the pipeline, which is the claim payment, which, as you just alluded to, is really the most important part from the customer perspective. And the insurers who acknowledge that are the ones who stand to win the most. But then when we look at our bigger customers, sometimes there the consideration is more in how do we avoid disrupting existing workflow too much? How do we tie into legacy systems we already have? So this could be a tech light integration instead of a from scratch API integration or an overhaul, and finding out the ways to fit in those existing processes and leverage flows they might already have. Maybe they already collect certain information for us, right? And we can play off of that as opposed to provide some of our no-code solutions or API solutions to do banking KYC, for example. Those things can change as you move up market.
Yeah, that's a conundrum we've been talking about quite recently in the office and on various versions of the podcast. Is you know, there is no one insurer client, you know, because they're all at different stages of their tech journey. They have different customers. Is it quite difficult to avoid being almost like a consulting shop sometimes when you're kind of, you know, because you want your set client, presumably, where you can just plug in an API and off they go. But yeah, how difficult is that challenge when you're kind of trying to grow, particularly when you're trying to acquire that first customer, I'd imagine, when you're earlier in your journey?
Yeah, that's, I think, part of the real sauce of being a savvy entrepreneur. And it's not without its mistakes. Like, to be clear, I don't think anyone has a clear path towards knowing exactly what to build and how to build it on day one, because it's just an ever-evolving journey. So I think the biggest things in productization of what could be consulting services is really understanding what the commonalities are between customers, enough to understand what are the core problems being solved and how do we make that as automatic as possible. And then we provide some sort of room for the right clients to be able to mix and match certain offerings or features in a way that's still synergistic with the product as a whole. And that's really hard to do. And that's why entrepreneurship, one of the reasons why it's really hard. But when you do it, that's where you see the massive value that a SaaS company can generate when you really hit that product market fit on the head and you don't have to reinvent the wheel for every client. And all of a sudden, you start getting reliable bookings and the same things you're hearing are the same things that you're seeing with new customers.
Yeah, I see them objectively when I work with, you know, work with clients or I'm talking to, you know, just networking in the space, and you see these businesses where I think they get pulled into almost sort of it changes similar to what we were talking about with the venture feedback, is that they end up kind of in this space where they keep adapting their product just to suit the one customer, and it's not actually solving the problems for the whole. But I think that's a unique challenge that's, it's not that it's overlooked. I just don't think sometimes it's talked about enough that people are on different stages of their journey.
Definitely.
Just nuts and bolts stuff, actually, before we kind of go in. So, what lines of business do you cover with the Snap Refund product?
Yeah, so right now Snap Refund is focusing its first product, Claim Snap, that's what launched in August of 2023, on property and casualty and life insurance primarily. So we really touch everything but health is probably the best way to say it. And with that, we're servicing MGAs, third-party admins, and carriers.
Nice. And do you white label it? Is that how it works, or is it a mixture of
Yep.
not white
So
label
it's
to white label?
either or. So we could white label it, gray label it, no label it. You could just have the dashboard as it looks. It's really up to our client if they want to have things be invisible, and we're an engine behind the scenes. or if they want to leverage our pre-built widgets and UI flows on day one.
Right. Right. Because I think sometimes we can talk about these things, but it's that, isn't it? Like insurance is a workflow, you know, that whole from policy that, you know, to distribute to policy to claims. And sometimes we talk about things and we're not clear about kind of where it fits in. So I think it's always really, really important. And talking about that, you know, when we look at, you know, ClaimSnap, like, have you seen any sort of innovative like applications of your product that, you know, customers either used it in a different way or they've kind of suggested things that kind of have surprised you?
Well, that's a great question. So one of the things that we picked up early on that surprised us that became a feature that ended up being quite useful for all of our customers was one of our customers asked us, hey, we have our loss account, you know, that we're paying our claims out of, but we're auditing that really tightly. So when there's any transaction costs that come out of this, could you take that out of a separate account? And we thought about it and said, oh, that's something we could definitely do. And let's look at how that could work. So then we added in this feature to allow our clients to add a bank account for platform costs and a separate bank account for their loss accounting. And with that, we realized that cleaning up the audit trail of a lot of these operations was one of the core workflows of a claims team. And by listening to the market, it led us down a path where we can start to understand how to optimize features like the one that we just made to make that system that much easier for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, that's that kind of beautiful feedback that you really, really want. And someone asks, like, can it do this? It's like, well, why haven't you done that before? It's a weird question because it's not even a demand. It's like, can it do this? It's like, oh, great question. In a similar vein, I always think the challenges of the things like this is that you've got your customer that is paying for the product, which is, you know, that's an insurer as an example, an MGA, and then you've probably got the end kind of consumer of that product. So you've got different stakeholders in this. What kind of elements of the app relating to your product have received the kind of most positive feedback? What are people valuing in the kind of the use of the Snap product?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, as a payments company that's doing anything involving a flow of funds, they like, as they should, that it works and it has to just work at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But beyond that, the simplicity has been really, really well applauded by not only just our end users, the policyholders who are receiving their claim payment in this really slick way, where they get a link on their phone and they can cash out the method they're choosing, and it's all fast and streamlined and really puts a lot of the transparency on the table that's not there typically. They don't have to call in and ask what their claim status is. They see it right there in the transaction history. But also on the insurer side, something that's been really interesting is that our insurers have also applauded the simplicity, where they look and see, look, we can run our whole claims operation off of, you know, a handful of API calls, or just use this no-code dashboard and upload mass spreadsheets, send a million payments at the same time, send them one by one, and we can cancel them as needed. And that level of simplicity combined with control has created a really graceful, sleek experience for our existing clients.
From the kind of like the claimant that's getting that payment, I'm sure this is an analogy we got from you, but I had written down here. It's like seeing that your Uber's arriving, because that must be the most common complaint. I mean, that's like I've had to, fortunately, touch wood, I've had two insurance claims my whole life that I've needed to claim for, and the biggest mystery was like, when was I ever going to see any money? Is that the kind of like the thing that people seem to value the most from the kind of claimant perspective? Because that for me seems like so simple, but takes 90% of the frustration away.
Totally. Look, and when it comes down to it, why does anyone have insurance? It's so when they file a claim, they get paid. So while it may not always be intuitive, I think for people who are in these decision-making positions to realize just how powerful controlling that moment can be, it really is the single biggest touch point that controls everything. And that's why we see a lot of policyholders today they end up churning after they get paid. I mean, you're talking about 1 in 4 people in the US typically leave after they get paid. And that unexpected churn costs insurers a very serious amount, right? These are tangible problems that have tangible impacts on bottom lines. So when you really put the policyholder or the claimant in the focus there, it's a really interesting control surface that can yield some pretty serious rewards for your business when you handle it appropriately.
I was just thinking that both of my insurers I switched from after my claims experience, because
exactly
the claims experience was awful. And yeah, it was almost, and I think that's the time when you're, you know, we've talked many times on the podcast about policy wordings are too complex and they're not clear enough. And, you know, we have the same thing. I mean, I've spoken on this quite recently. My parents are going for a claim, and my parents are not that old, but they're older. They're dealing with this like convoluted language. They're dealing with language they don't particularly understand, because they're talking legalese and insurance speak. And that lack of transparency, that lack of clarity is at every point of the insurance value chain. And that's hard enough for us to understand. We operate in the space. You know, I always think that I buy insurance cover and I think, objectively, I'm not sure I fully understand what I'm covered for and whatnot. Yeah. I'm just kind of hoping, you know. But that transparency piece at the end, particularly, surely from a kind of ROI, must be enormous, because just being transparent and clear and having a good claims process, I'd love to see in 5 years' time what the data says about keeping that customer, because so would you, right? It'd be a good sales tool.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's no question that insurers need to be more profitable, right? That's what drives their motivation. At the end of the day, it's better loss ratios, more premium dollars collected. And when you take this tip of the journey, which really is like kind of the iceberg, because it seems sometimes like it's just one tiny part of the end, but no, that is where the majority of the customer perception and experience is going to be won or lost. It's really an opportunity for insurers to increase the value of their own, really make their stakeholders, which includes the claimant and the insured, as happy as possible. And obviously that is what wins in the end. When you have happy customers and you get more of them, it's kind of a no-brainer at that point.
Yeah. So we're talking about settled claims at the moment, but one of the things that I'm interested in is have you thought about going to a different point in the claims value chain? If you looked at like arbitration and arbitration claims?
It's interesting you say that, actually. So we've been looking at certain areas, and there's a lot of room for improvement, I think, along the value chain, especially when it comes to arbitration. You talk about how do you get people to an agreement as quickly as possible? Because I don't think anyone except lawyers really like it when that drags on. They're going to get their due regardless. So one of the tactics an attorney actually told me one time, and I actually met them at InsurTech Insights last year over the summer, they had mentioned to me, you know, going into a negotiation for arbitration with a blank check and they only have one of it is a common tactic they've seen in their career, where they tell the opposing counsel, look, we have one check. We can agree on the number to write on this and you can leave with it, or I'm going to take this back or get approval and this process is going to keep going on. And the power of being able to close a deal when you introduce scarcity is pretty notable. So I think when you look at solutions and how there's tech that can help with arbitration or other pieces of the value chain as it relates to claims, I think there's a wide canvas there that we're going to continue to see more innovation within over the coming years.
Yeah, it seems such an obvious place to start, right? Because, you know, nobody wants it to drag on forever, as you say, apart from lawyers. Everyone's probably got roughly a number in their head, insurers and insureds. They're probably not a million miles apart, like a lot of the time, I would imagine. So the back and forth is just, it's part of that time suck. It's part of that kind of bad experience. And really, it's like, you know, for an insurance company, let's say they're going to save a couple of points on the dollar, which all right, on the aggregate adds up. But if you're also losing those customers at the end of every bad experience that they have, that long term is and it's a long term business. And it's funny when we look at these little interactions, because you go, it's a short term approach to a long term business, really. So totally. Yeah, fascinating. I wanted to talk to you briefly about textiles, because you were part of the Textiles Accelerator. What was that experience like, and what were the benefits really of going through a program like that?
It was incredible. It was one of my most exciting times in my career, and it's a really kind of bittersweet that it's already over. We graduated in October because we really dug in and made the most of it and loved the team and all the cohort companies. And they're all people that I still talk to every day now. So it's really been amazing. The experience, what it was like. So you start off, after you get into the program, it kicks off with at least ours, Techstars Boulder, with customer research. And they're teaching you principles around how to be scientific and how to try to avoid biases in the way that you go about these research patterns. And then as you go through the program for 3 months, it starts being a structured curriculum almost, where they give you some books to read, like Venture Deals is a great book, also Sell More Faster. And they try to really build that foundation. Even if you know some of these things or all of them, they really want to hone in and help you improve. And even if you're, like, I always love this example. Someone said Denzel Washington still takes acting classes. And I remember thinking, like, okay, like, what does he have to learn? But if someone as good at their craft as that still thinks they have things to learn, I think it really speaks to how everyone can always try to take that learner's mindset and keep improving. And Techstars really hones in on that. So there's multiple time founders, some who even exit their companies, who still go through it and still dedicate themselves to picking up on little things they might have not have known. Or if you don't know much at all, it's a great place to start learning. So it was awesome to go to that program and just get another crash course on the latest and greatest best practices as an entrepreneur. And then things start gearing up towards a demo day, where they drill you ruthlessly. Probably the most prepared for a pitch in my life was through Techstars. And I think I'm pretty proficient at pitching, but I learned new memorization techniques and little things, little tells and ways to really maximize like audience engagement, how to pause at the right places for impact, what types of narrative you want to build towards, and how you crescendo that in the pitch. Those are all things that Techstars really started lasering in on the closer we got to demo day. And they don't let you on the stage unless they feel like you're ready. So it really presents an opportunity for you to have to challenge yourself and say, all right, it's not just going to be a throwaway, whatever thing. We're going through this program. At the end, you want to have this really awesome moment where you can pitch and showcase the awesome work your team has done. And all that being said, we did that in October. We got really good response and feedback. We got to pitch at the Google headquarters in Colorado for demo day, and it went amazingly. There were a few investors we actually met through that process along the way. They're now on our cap table today, and they're riding with the team. So I have nothing but the best to say for Techstars. It really was incredible.
Amazing. Yeah, I was going to throop at that and saying, yeah, did it have a sort of tangible impact on your ability to raise? And, yes, it did, because there's people in the room came on the cap table. So there we go. There we go. But yeah, it's great. I mean, I think it's fascinating. I now want to go on it. I'm
You
so sold.
should.
I'm
You
like,
should. I'll make an intro for you if you
I
need.
just want to learn how to pitch like that. I was like, yeah, that sounds exciting. I want to hone my pitch. I think, funny enough, we're doing that internally at the moment. We're going, yeah, the pitch right. Because you really think there's always how you perceive what you're trying to proposition to the world. And actually, sometimes it's not, you've got the right product and you've got the wrong pitch. And I find that kind of fascinating. And obviously, we do it in a very different way. But like, for example, we really headhunting and the business that we do, and for anyone who's never listened before, FinPro is my business, and we're a headhunting firm for insurtechs, is that we're going one-to-one pitching a client's business on their behalf. So we're giving the elevator version of this is the company, this is why you should join them, this is the mission. So we're pitching all the time, and then that's what we were looking at and saying, right, because if we pitch it wrong, the person's not going to join. Now, I'd like to think we're pretty good at it, but it's that thinking of going, it doesn't matter how long you've been in business, it doesn't matter if you've exited a business. I love this so much value in essentially going back to school and saying, what can I learn from this experience? So how long's the program actually? How long were you in it for?
Yes, 3 months. So we were in the summer cohort for Boulder 2023. We started in sometime midsummer. I think I want to say July, August, and then it ended in October.
Right. Is Boulder home for you, or is that?
No. So St. Louis, Missouri is home, born and raised. I'm a proud Midwestern guy. And then I moved to Philadelphia a few years back. I've been in Philly, is where I met my co-founder, actually. all the way back, and I think it's been like 6 or 7 years now we've known each other, and we eventually would come to start Snap Refund together. But Boulder is a place that I've really loved. I just love Colorado. I'm a huge outdoors guy. Love to hike.
Mm.
And I went out there to backpack with a few of my friends and my dog Ace it is a while ago now, 2017. And we were out there in the woods, you know, at the foot of these mountains, looking up at the stars every night. And I really fell in love with Colorado then and thought it'd be an awesome place to live one day. So when we got into Techstars Boulder, it was a really beautiful coincidence because we got to spend a lot of time out there. And after work every day, we would go out there. It was remote, but it was hybrid. So we would choose me and my co-founder to go work out of Boulder sometimes.
Yeah.
And after work, we would go hop on a hiking trail and go look up at the stars and go walk and enjoy the mountain air. And that was really awesome for us.
I keep thinking about it. I need to relocate to the States. I'm going to be in New York for the next month. And I love New York, but I live in London. And I'm like, New York's just sort of London slightly on steroids probably. And then the other part of me is exactly as you. I love that outdoors lifestyle. So I'm a bit like, I need to go to Boulder rather, but we'll see. It's probably not as good for business, but you know, we live in a remote world, so who cares? Last question I've got for you, and just really conscious of time, is you've got your own podcast. We're in a podcast. I wanted to talk to you about your own podcast. And you've been really very much sharing this journey that you've been on, and I love that idea. But why did you think it was important, relevant to do it? What was you thinking? And then obviously, how have you found that experience? Because I love doing it. I think it's my favorite part of my job. So how have you found it?
Yeah, the idea came about when my co-founder Anis suggested it. Anis is a marketing genius, and he's been really good about finding ways to attract attention and traction from the right folks to the business. And it was, you know, a couple of years ago at this point, that he just said, like, hey, we should do a podcast and document this journey. And the goal that he came with was to be able to help other founders or people who might be going through these situations to just have a voice of solidarity and someone that they can look at and just say, like, yeah, like, these guys are going through something that I've already been through or something that I'm going to go through soon, and give people that outlet for all that energy. Because this stuff is hard. I mean, it has like really, really high highs, but really low lows as well. So we wanted to just be able to share an experience, because there's also a lot of people that we met that might have been entrepreneurs at one point, but have given that up, but still like to be a part of it and still feel what the journey is like, that they might have related to themselves or still have interest in. So it's been interesting for us to do that. And it gives people a lot of like data, you know, on us, or information. If someone's going to meet with us, they can really see, like, hey, who are these guys? What are they like? You know, how do they go about things? And that's been an interesting source, I think, of familiarity for people sometimes, and has done pretty well at attracting people to us and just giving them a sense of what it's like to be in the room with the Snap Refund team.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I talk about it a lot, and you know, one of the things that we thankfully we're 250 episodes out now, and we don't always have to sell it, thank you. But we do sell it, obviously, because there's some people we're desperate to have on, and we're like, we've assumed you to get on the podcast, right? I'm going to say that now. So I was like, you know, we wanted to do this, and because it's just we're interested in the business and people with interesting journeys, and you know. But what I say is that the world's flipped on its head, and people used to work for big corporate businesses and or just any business, and you kept everything in house, and it was like, no, we've got the secret sauce. And I think really the realization is that there is secret sauce, but there's not much of it. And actually, most of it is we're all doing it. Some people are executing it better, or they've got a better team to execute upon that. And that's the stuff that I always push my clients, particularly in the hiring space. It's like, you want to be as visible as possible, because if you have got a great team and you're doing interesting things, or you've got great values, but it's that opportunity to share them. And it opens so many doors for you about the type of person you are and the type of people that you are, the team you're building, the journey you're on. And there's no better way of selling that. So I'm going to do a shameless segue into say, Cody, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your journey on the Leadership and Insurance podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. And look, we've really invested in the business space. Fingers crossed. I know that the raise is coming close, getting there. But hopefully, we'll get to announce that at a similar time when this comes out. And I hope we get to see you again very, very, very soon.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.